Welcome to Research Reframed, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on research, insights, and data science. I'm your host, Jasmina Saleh, Director of Thought Leadership at National Research Group. We're a global insights consultancy at the intersection of content, culture, and technology. And in each episode, we dive deep into the trends, tools, and tensions that are shaping the future of the research industry. Today, we're looking at a new frontier, how generative AI is opening up entirely new ways to gather and interpret data. Of course, there's been a huge amount of discussion about the role of AI within the industry over the past few years, from the implications for data quality control to the role that custom GPTs can play in democratizing access to insights. But in this episode, we'll be spotlighting one of the most exciting ways that AI is reshaping the research industry, how it's expanding the definition of data and opening the door for entirely new forms of analysis. And to do that, we'll be using a case study from a recent research initiative at NRG conducted in partnership with Young Storytellers, a nonprofit that runs creative writing workshops for kids and teens. In this study, entitled Growing Pains, we used AI to analyze over 7,000 stories written by school children to understand how the experience of navigating the world as a young person has really evolved over the past two decades, looking at their hopes, looking at their fears, and also their emotional needs. As well as unpacking the findings themselves, we'll explore what this methodology tells us about where research itself is heading. Joining me today are two of the brains behind it all, Fergus Navaratnam-Blair, our VP of Thought Leadership and the lead writer on the piece, and Alan Miyazaki from our data science team, who helped turn a mountain of messy stories into structured AI-powered insights. Welcome both. How are you both doing?
Very good. Thank you for having us on the show.
Doing great. Thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure having you both. I would love it if you could quickly introduce yourselves properly.
Yeah, of course. My name's Fergus. I'm a VP in our Trends and Futures team here at NRG. As Jazz mentioned, I look after a lot of our public-facing research, our white papers, articles, blogs, etc., including the specific project that we're going to be talking about a lot today.
Hi, my name is Alan Miyazaki. I'm a senior data analyst on our marketing sciences team. We handle advanced analytics. This was a very unique project for our department. Super excited to discuss it today.
So, Fergus, let's start with the broader picture. There's a lot of buzz about AI and research, but for you, what was the real opportunity here with this project that Alan obviously opened up about a little bit more? So, why did this feel like the right moment to experiment with using AI to unlock new forms of data?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, as you say, it kind of goes without saying that AI has already had, is going to have a really profound impact on the research and insights industry as a whole. I mean, if you've been to any research conference within the last 2-3 years, you've heard, you know, almost half the panels these days are about applications for AI, challenges of AI. I think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit out there in that respect, you know, things like using LLMs to help draft surveys or discussion guides, for example, speed up some of those kind of operational processes, you know, helping with initial analysis passes on survey data. There's a whole universe of kind of AI applications within the insights industry. The thing, though, that I personally have been really interested in, really excited by, has been the opportunities that are out there to really use AI to unlock new types of data, new modes of analysis. And we see that, for example, I think over the last few years in the explosion of these kind of qualit scale platforms, for example, you know, platforms like Remesh that use these kind of AI moderators to conduct focus groups or conduct interviews at a scale that wouldn't previously have been possible. We're also starting to see that, though, in thematic analysis of content libraries. So powering up social listening, for example, fueling the analysis of digital content, you know, these types of applications. And that's really what we were taking inspiration from in this project here. When you are working with AI, obviously you have to be aware of the limitations of the technology. You have to be aware of what it can do, what it can't do, some of the dangers around hallucinations and so on. I'm sure we'll get into some of those and how we mitigated against some of those later in the conversation. And I do think sometimes there is a tendency to kind of shove AI into everything these days. I don't think that's necessarily the right approach. But what we do know about AI and about, you know, generative AI, LLMs in particular, is that it is very good at seeing patterns in data. It is very good at converting data from one format into another. That is fundamentally, after all, what LLMs are at the end of the day. They are pattern machines. They are trained to predict the next token in a string of output tokens. So that is really what we wanted to do here, what we wanted to lean into. You know, taking this huge volume of unstructured data, these stories written by kids, we wanted to see, you know, is there a way that we can use some of these relatively new technologies to try and convert all of that data into a form that we could meaningfully interrogate, meaningfully analyze in a way that wouldn't necessarily have been possible in the past with the kind of the resources that we had access to.
That's brilliant. Thank you for explaining that. What was it about young storytellers that really built this direction of the research? So can you just tell us a little bit more about that partnership and how their archive essentially inspired this study?
They approached us early last year with an interest in collaborating on research around this kind of big theme of the evolution of childhood. So trying to understand all of the ways in which the experience of growing up, the experience of sort of navigating the world as a young person, trying to understand how that's changed over the past 20 years or so, driven by new technologies, new forms of media, new types of content, but also kind of wider social, cultural, even political trends. And I think the fact that this was a research program focused specifically on kids and teenagers really was a part of what made this AI-driven approach make a lot of sense in this context. So anyone who's tried researching kids in the past will know this is a very difficult audience to reach through traditional research techniques. They are very difficult to find and target, and they are not necessarily always able to engage with some of the more complex questions that we might put to an adult audience through surveys or focus groups or so on. So you do have to already kind of think outside the box a little bit when you're trying to really understand how kids see the world, where they're coming from on their own terms. This is an audience that tends to get talked down to a lot in the kind of wider cultural conversation about the role of young people in society. There's been so much debate in the media about kids' exposure to media, how they're navigating sort of digital spaces, kids' safety. A lot of these conversations, though, are really driven by us as adults talking at young people or talking on behalf of young people, you know, telling them all the things their generation is doing wrong, all these sorts of things. So when we were scoping out this project with young storytellers, when we were looking at their data archive, we realized, hey, there's this huge repository of stories here. It really gives us a unique chance to look at this audience through their own voices. So rather than starting with our preconceptions as adults about what kids care about, we are able to see how kids express themselves freely when they're given the resources and the support to do that, when they're in this kind of context where you can organically see these themes and concerns and hopes and fears kind of bubble up to the surface. And then on top of that, the fact that this archive went back all the way to around 2006, 2007, I believe, that meant that we were able to track some of these themes longitudinally over time. Of course, you know, we can't go back in time. We can't retrospectively survey kids 10 years ago, what they think about all of these different issues. But when you have this kind of organic data that stretches back so far, it starts to enable some really powerful, really compelling stories to emerge about the changes over time across some of these themes.
Before we get into, you know, what we uncovered, Alan, let's talk about the method to the madness. So this was one of our boldest uses of generative AI to date. So how did you go about transforming more than 7,000, and I want to emphasize, handwritten stories into structured insights?
In terms of how we wanted to go about this, we knew very quickly that this is something that we would need to automate to some degree. There's no way that we would have someone or even multiple analysts trying to submit several prompts. We submitted over, I want to say, about 200 different prompts to figure out how these stories would be contextualized by the LLM we ended up going with. And in terms of scale, there's just no way to do that several thousand times, especially in a timely manner. We want to make sure that this is something that would be relatively easy to test on our end. One member on our team, Cole Landel, he was able to develop a fantastic script using Python, which would allow us to leverage the batch method, which means we were able to submit several prompts to an instance of the LLM at a time. This dramatically sped up how quick we could be asking the LLM prompts and basically cut down the potential time from, I want to say, about a week of processing down to about 90 hours. A bit more manageable, still pretty intense for sure. If automation was not an option for this, I really don't know how we would have accomplished this project.
You make a really good point there, Alan, about data quality and quality control, not necessarily something you think about when you're kind of brainstorming, thinking about all these creative applications for AI, but so much of this project was about that kind of data quality aspect of things. You mentioned getting from the initial archive to where we could actually start running analysis, removing duplicates, for example. That took us from that initial archive of around 10,000 to the 7,000 stories that we ended up analyzing once we'd taken out those stories that appeared multiple times within the database. And then on top of that, we also had to think about quality control. You know, how do we account for factors like AI hallucination, for example?
We had to have some form of manual testing to get a sense of how accurate this entire process would be. For example, if we said, is the theme of friendship in this script? We didn't have another script for them to look at where we give them an example of friendship. So we just wanted to see how the generative AI would actually perform. From there, that's what allowed us to really get a sense of how well the models would perform. We were able to manually look at, it ended up being about 15 different scripts that we would manually review. And then from there, we would make sure that we were happy with the responses that the model gave. Almost all of the prompts themselves had yes-no answers or just strictly binary responses, which made it much easier to cut down on the ambiguity of whether or not the AI would hallucinate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that speaks to, you know, a wider conversation that keeps happening of, you know, how much human touch do you want with AI? And this speaks to how important it was with a study like this. Alan, I don't know if you had any more to add, but I'd also be curious about whether there were any unexpected ethical challenges that surfaced during the research process.
Again, a very important aspect of the whole project. That's something that our team always had, I'm not even going to say in the back of our heads, it was in the forefront of how we handled this. Looking at gender, for example, we found that there were a few different instances where the model would claim someone was non-binary, for example. And to me, that stood out as I was doing my manual review. I was like, okay, great. You know, these seem to be examples from 2020 onwards. And I think it would be pretty reasonable for that to be the case. I went to the scripts themselves to take a look, and there was no indication that the author was non-binary. It ended up just being a case where the author hadn't used any pronouns in particular, but I didn't see any instances of they, them, for example, which would maybe give the indication that they're non-binary. So yeah, I think in situations like that, I had to choose whether to include the script for having every other prompt being a viable answer, and whether or not a single prompt that I would consider incorrect is enough to invalidate that for our analysis. And so it definitely was one of those instances where we had to look at so many different, I want to say, like, qualifications in terms of how we wanted to apply these different scripts to our final results. You know, for a lot of these different findings that we had, we didn't necessarily look at the entire population of scripts because we wanted to kind of mitigate those issues that we ran into.
One of the other limitations or challenges that came up as we were working on this from a research perspective and in terms of how we were analyzing and interpreting that data was really about finding the right level of analysis to focus on and calibrating those themes and those prompts in a way that really reflected the nature of what kids were writing about. So trying to find themes that showed up in that sweet spot where they were showing up enough to be relevant, but not so much that it kind of drowned out your ability to see change over time. So when we look at this archive of stories, there are certain themes in there like friendship and family and identity and so on that are showing up in so many of these stories because of just the way that kids write and the way that the program itself is designed. So it's very difficult when you have these themes that are showing up in like 80%, 90% plus of stories, it's very difficult to see interesting changes over time within that. And then equally, we had some other themes we started exploring where they just weren't showing up enough to be statistically relevant. So things like, you know, cryptocurrency, for example, just not enough of that in the stories themselves to be able to kind of tell those stories about trends and evolution over time.
The main horror of using generative AI is hallucinating. The idea that it'll just come up with something just because it might think that that's what the user wants to see. When running these prompts, we have a gauge within the Python script itself, which determines the temperature, which is essentially what determines how loose or strict we want to be with generative AI hallucinations, or I guess creativity might be a better word for that, since hallucinations is just purely negative. But creativity wise, we were able to see, okay, if we're giving this model as much freedom as possible, then what can it come up with if we're asking for it to determine whether or not there are themes of friendship or themes of strife or conflict? You know, how likely is it going to be to detect those in stories where a human might argue they're not present? So we did plenty of testing going over the different intervals. The temperature went from 0 and 2. That's the scale for it. And we found that a temperature of 0 was just really the only way to mitigate those hallucinations to a degree where we were happy with. I really don't think anything above the strict limit of 0 was going to get us anywhere in terms of any amount of accuracy. I was very surprised with how, you know, it was kind of a, I don't know if you're familiar with, like, if you give a mouse a cookie type story, like, or, you know, give them an inch, they'll take a mile. That's kind of how it felt. The generative AI models that we use just would, if there was any amount of freedom when it came to being able to detect some of these topics or themes, and we gave them the freedom to do so, it absolutely would hallucinate to its heart's content. So yeah, I think one of the biggest hurdles for us was trying to ensure that hallucinations were cut as much as possible, and that in the end it would be something that we handled anyway. Yeah, for those that kind of slipped through the cracks, if we had any instances where prompts were consistently providing us with hallucinations, then that was an indication to us that we needed to go back and either kind of retool the prompt or maybe ditch it entirely. Like Fergus said, it's an iterative process. So it wasn't something where we had to fully commit to a specific verbiage per se. Mm-hmm.
So you weren't only wrangling 7,000 stories, you were wrangling the AI itself as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So obviously we've covered the sort of why and the how, that method to the madness. And now I'd like to kind of shift gears and focus on what this approach actually uncovered. I mean, Fergus, you touched on themes and so on. I think this whole project in particular really showcases what becomes visible when we analyze open-ended emotional stories at this scale. So Fergus, can you share an example or two of insights that felt like aha moments, you know, things that we probably wouldn't have caught through more traditional surveys or focus groups?
Yeah, there's a few things that come to mind. I should say as well, you know, part of the role of doing this analysis was not just the AI analysis itself, but also then using that to power a quantitative study of kids and teens. So part of this was directional in nature. As you say, it gave us those interesting areas and topics that came up when kids have that kind of freedom to express themselves that we could then probe more deeply and try and put harder numbers against through a follow-up quant study that we conducted. But there were definitely a few areas that really stood out just from that AI-assisted analysis process. I think one of them in particular was the complexities of the relationship that kids have with technology. That was a big theme that really stood out to me looking at all of this data. You really see how central kids' devices, their social media platforms, etc., how central they are to their lives. Kids were writing about technology very often in their stories, and when they were doing so, they mostly presented it as a form of entertainment or as a solution to problems rather than as a source of conflict or tension within their narratives. But having said all of that, there are definitely some complexities that start to emerge when you look beyond the surface there, particularly when you start looking at subgroups within that population. So for example, when we start carving up that data by gender, we start to see, you know, boys are engaging with technology more, they're writing about it more within their stories, and they're also doing so in a more positive way. And that was a consistent pattern over time. If anything, the gap there between how boys approached writing about technology versus how girls did, that's only been growing larger over time within the sort of two decades or so we were able to look at within this archive of stories. Compared to boys, we see girls framing technology in either a more value neutral way or even an outright negative way. So they're more likely to explore themes like social media addiction or cyberbullying, for example. And I think that's really interesting, not only because it speaks to the unique challenges that girls specifically face when it comes to kind of navigating today's media and technology landscape, but I also think it reflects the kind of very deeply gendered relationship that we as a broader society have with science, technology, kind of all these related topics. I mean, you know, even though women are more likely to attend university now than men, they're more likely to graduate from higher education, they are still underrepresented in STEM fields. Only about a third of STEM graduates are women. Only about a third of America's STEM workforce is female. So it's really interesting looking at this data. You get to see how early on in our lives those kind of gendered relationships with technology are being formed.
To come full circle, Fergus, we've obviously been talking about using AI to come to these conclusions, but I remember also reading that AI is going to be an integral part of Gen Alpha growing up, and that nearly half of teens and kids aged 6 to 12 say they now interact with AI chatbots or assistants on at least a weekly basis. How do you think that's going to affect Gen Alpha in a way?
Yeah, I think that's such a huge question. I think, you know, I was just at the Children's Media Conference here in the UK a couple of weeks ago, hearing from media brands and tech companies and other research agencies about some of the work they're doing on young kids. And just so much conversation about the role that these chatbots are playing in kids' lives. You know, all these stories about children turning to AI increasingly, not just as a tool to help them with homework or to help find information, but increasingly as a source of companionship as well. There are positives and negatives to that. Obviously, it raises some really profound, I think, questions about socialization and are kids getting the chance to kind of learn how to interact with humans? Are they learning how to interact with peers in a kind of traditional way? But also, I think to some extent, it's kind of filling a void that's left by other factors. I think there was a video clip of a young girl, I think she was 11 or 12 years old, talking about how she turns to AI because it's a non-judgmental space. You know, sometimes her friends don't reply to her, they don't add her to their group chats. And so she uses AI to kind of fill that gap. And I think, you know, to me, that isn't about the technology itself. It's about the broader social challenge there, the failing that I guess we've had as adults in creating those kind of safe spaces for kids. And I think AI in that kind of sense, it's a bit of a band-aid for some of those questions. And I think it raises some very important questions, very important prompts for us as adults thinking about, you know, how we give kids the right guardrails, the right kind of opportunities to find those connections, to have those kind of meaningful engagements and interactions with their peers, with their friends.
Yeah, that breaks my heart.
I know, it's a little bleak. It's very fascinating to see how different generations are looking at this. Obviously there's a lot of conflict within, I want to say, like millennial spaces, not really knowing exactly how to handle this new technology, whereas Gen Z is totally divided on the entire topic, and Gen Alpha is probably just excited to have something new to play with. It's very interesting to see how these generational divides have kind of grown with such a powerful new piece of technology nowadays.
My own Gen Alpha toddler he's only 2.5 at the moment. So fortunately, it's not something we've had to deal with yet, but it's definitely something that, you know, I'm going to have to think about in the future. I know a lot of parents are thinking about how you give kids the right tools to kind of be able to safely engage with that technology. You know, how you teach them to talk to robots is going to be such a big question in the future. Like, do you want to raise your kids to say please and thank you when they're talking to chatbots and robots and these sorts of things? What does that say about, you know, how they kind of inculcate these behaviors that they're then going to apply elsewhere? Do you want them to kind of have this idea of like a kind of inanimate servant in your house? How's that going to impact how they treat other people? You know, there's so many questions there that I think a lot of parents are grappling with or will have to grapple with in the very near future.
When COVID hit in particular, third places really became very minimal. And so there's this need for connection through the digital world because obviously physical spaces just became very limited. And I also remember, I think it was Alan, actually, when you first presented the findings, something that made me really quite sad was that post-pandemic happy endings and stories dropped from about 80% to just 66%. And, you know, from a data science perspective, Alan, what did it feel like to surface patterns like this from such emotionally complex inputs?
Yeah, that was definitely quite shocking. But I guess when I saw that, I went back to the prompt to make sure that it made sense how the LLM decided to look at that, like what classifies as a happy ending, what's a negative. And neutral, of course, was also an option. So I wanted to make sure that it wasn't potentially hallucinating in a way that, you know, maybe neutral endings were negative because they didn't say they all lived happily ever after at the end. You know, I wanted to make sure that there was some control there to ensure that there weren't any hallucinating. And from looking at the prompts that we had manually looked at and the tests, it all seemed to be perfectly reasonable. The LLM was performing exactly how we expected. And for my team, we were just kind of blown away by the difference. You know, maybe like a 5 to 6% difference would be something that's still, you know, not negligible, something that we could report on. But by seeing it fall by so much is definitely eye-opening, you know, to say the least. One of the main aspects of that was that we don't see a shift like that between years, like 2020 to 2021. Like we do not see that difference for any other period of time. I want to say off memory, I don't think any other prompts had such a severe difference yearly.
Yeah, I mean, I think you raise a really good point. The impact of COVID was a huge theme throughout this analysis. The endings of stories, but also in other places, there were other data points where we could see very steep drop-offs or increases around 2021 that really did seem to be in response to the pandemic. And I think looking at all of it in the aggregate, looking at the data from this analysis plus the data from the quant study that it helped to fuel and enable, my takeaway from all of that is that certainly COVID had a profound impact on young people, but it was both a direct and an indirect impact. So there were very direct impacts in terms of the way in which the pandemic accelerated the digitization of childhood. You know, we see, you know, kids in 2021 significantly less likely to write about sports, for example, because they're not having the same opportunities to play and watch sports. They're spending that time playing video games instead. We see schools during that period investing so much money in educational technology, in devices, in remote learning solutions. We see kids being kind of forced further and further into these kind of digital spaces. So that's a very direct impact of the pandemic. But then I think there are some, in some ways, bigger kind of indirect mindset shifts that it brought about. I think it wasn't just about the pandemic itself. It's more about what it represented in kids' minds, the way in which, you know, we see when we look at our data, we see kids have all of these kind of big fears about the world, you know, things like war and climate change and political instability, you know, all these kinds of concerns fueled by what they're hearing about in their households, what they're seeing on their social media feeds, you know, all these types of challenges. And COVID, in many ways, I think, helped to crystallize and make tangible a lot of those other fears. So previously, I think a lot of these tended to be things that you would read about as happening to other people. And COVID showed these kind of Gen Alpha kids as they're growing up, it really showed them that, no, actually, you as a kid in a wealthy country like the US, you are not immune to these challenges and problems either. It showed them very tangibly just how quickly you can go from reading about a news story happening, you know, happening in China, happening literally the other side of the world, how quickly you can go from that to having your own life impacted and upended. So it's not just about COVID and the pandemic. It's about how this ties into these kind of broader more sort of systematic, deeper fears that kids have about the direction of our planet, the direction of society.
Yeah, to kind of talk about the impact COVID had from a child's perspective, it's interesting for us as researchers. Gaming, for example, just exploded in terms of the prevalence of it in the stories pre and post pandemic. We see a spike there, along with the decrease in negative stories. Not to say that the stories about gaming were negative per se, but it was very interesting to see how these trends were impacted by COVID. And it's a lot of it's just indirect.
I think you bring up a very good point around the intersection of like video games and generally also another point that we discovered in the data, which was around escapism, and that kids are obviously, they need escapism in content to really grapple with these realities. And I feel like video games is that perfect intersection where they can escape, but they also can connect online in these digital spaces. I just want to shift gears to the idea around sort of how this really reframes research. So as is evident through this study, I'd like to think that at NRG, we are always innovating with our research. We're always pushing boundaries and experimenting, as has been discussed at length in this conversation. So I really want to ask, what does this tell us about the broader opportunity for AI and research? And Fergus, maybe you can kick us off with, how should we be thinking about AI, not just as a tool to streamline analysis, but as a way to really expand what kinds of insights are even possible?
So I think fundamentally, when we think about the impact of AI, not just within the insights industry, but in the context of any industry, there are two ways to think about it. So there's the incremental approach. There's this question of how do we take these technologies and find ways to do what we're already doing, but more efficiently? How do we speed up our processes? How do we cut costs? How do we scale up kind of some of these processes that are already going on within our business? That's kind of one way of thinking about AI. And then on the other hand, there's the more transformative approach. So there's questions around, how can we take advantage of this technology to do things that we simply weren't able to do before? How do we use it to unlock new business models, create new types of customer value in the context of the insights industry? How does it create entirely new research methodologies, new approaches? To me, that's where the real opportunity within our industry lies, thinking about those kind of more transformative possibilities. I think the other thing I'll say here is it's very clear AI is in many ways sort of a double-edged sword for the insights industry. There's been a lot of concern lately within the industry about things like the impact of AI on data quality for online surveys. We see increasingly people using chatbots to game the system, to fill in surveys for them. We as research agencies are now having to come up with new ways of filtering out these kind of AI-generated responses, screening them out, ensuring data quality. It's at the point now where even video responses, video interviews can be faked through AI. So you're really having to think about how do we maintain the integrity of some of those methodologies that the industry has been really leaning on very heavily for decades at this point. But at the same time, I think what examples like this project that we've been talking about today really show is that, yes, AI does create all of these kind of pressures on existing research methodologies, but it also gives us the tools to solve those challenges. It also gives us the tools to unlock new forms of data that weren't necessarily available to us in the past, or find ways of interrogating data that didn't exist in the past. So I think AI creates this whole set of challenges, but it also gives us the tools to address some of those challenges and to find forms of data that fill the gap as we kind of move away from sort of historical reliance on some of these traditional methodologies.
And speaking of those methodologies, this method was especially powerful with kids whose communication is arguably often more imaginative and more indirect. So do you think younger audiences are a natural fit for this kind of research where you essentially have open-ended expression meeting machine-focused structure?
Yes, absolutely. As we talked about earlier, there are a lot of limitations when it comes to researching kids through more traditional research methodologies, finding these more imaginative, as you put it, more open-ended ways of understanding their perspectives is really valuable. I do think as well, though, that this is something that can be applied to a lot of specialist audiences, not just kids necessarily, but also some of these other kind of harder to reach audiences. I think about what it allows us to do for B2B audiences, for example, for, you know, senior executives. You know, how do you find content that they're writing or contributing to in their own, you know, LinkedIn posts or thought leadership articles and white papers and so on? How do you take that as a data source and start applying some of this kind of structure and methodology to it? I don't know, Alan, if you have any other perspectives on the sort of the unique opportunities more broadly for this type of approach.
One of the main parts that we can really leverage, and we weren't able to with this project in particular, is the fact that every single day these models are getting stronger. And, you know, if we did this project today compared to a year ago, who knows how different these models would perform, right? I mean, this was a project that we did for a nonprofit organization. We were being paid for it. So cost was definitely kind of top of mind as we were going about this. And because of that, we didn't leverage some of the strongest models out there that we had. And I think as AI continues to grow and strengthen, we see that the weakest models are still being kind of brought up. It's not like the weakest models are being kind of left behind and only the premium ones are performing, you know, where we would be able to apply them in research. All of the models are getting stronger and stronger. And I think that because of that, it would really open the doors to be able to apply this to, you know, so many different projects that have these kind of archive style databases where we have children's writing. I'm sure this would perform great with, you know, adult writing as well, as long as project leads and teams incorporate that ethical framework of, you know, having manual review, being able to check that this kind of work is something that reflects how a human would want to analyze it. I think it would perform great. And it's very exciting to see how this kind of work is used for any future projects that our team is going to tackle.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I think we've covered so much great ground, and I'm just very grateful for both of you coming on and, you know, unpacking how we did this, why we did this, and what we found.
Thank you for having us on. Great to get to talk about all of this.
Thank you so much.
So that's it for this episode of Research Reframed. If you enjoyed this episode, then please subscribe and share. And if you want to read the full Growing Pains report, you can download it on our website at nrgmr.com, or please go and check the show notes for all the relevant links. Research Reframed is produced by National Research Group, a global insights consultancy at the intersection of content, culture, and technology. Thanks for listening, and keep your ears perked for upcoming episodes where we'll dig into everything from AI methodologies to brand tracking myths to the future of qual. We'll see you next time.